Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to have you along today. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls. Carissa's at the phones. And you've heard it said, the central call of Christians is to love God and love others and to serve the least of these among us. Well, on today's Connecting Faith, we'll hear a call to move out of our comfort zones, to answer the question, who is my neighbor, and to renew our love for others by welcoming and serving the marginalized, the oppressed, and the vulnerable among us, and particularly those wanting to come to our shores to find refuge. And that is the key word. The topic today is refugees. And unless you have been avoiding news reports, this is a major story. Discussions across our land. We've invited a guest who is knowledgeable and thoughtful on the issues of refugees, immigration, and the scriptural mandate to show kindness to the stranger. That it is the story of the day.
It really is. And the temptation, I think, is there to kind of put our head in the sand, perhaps, and just say, well, this will pass, and I don't want to have to deal with it. I'm sick of it. But we are called to reach out, and this will be a good discussion on that.
Yeah. And thankful to have Matthew Sorens back with us. Matthew serves as the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. World Relief is the outreach development arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. If you were listening to Bill Meyer yesterday morning, you heard Matthew on, and I'm sure that he's been kind of doing nonstop interviews and the like since this story broke about the president's order, which has certainly caused a firestorm. Matthew's also previously served as field director for the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's a coalition of evangelical organizations of which World Relief is a founding member. We're going to hear a little bit more about that later. And he's co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. That came out here 4 or 5 years ago. And he is also one of the authors of the book Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, which came out here maybe just a few months ago, along with Stephen Bauman and Dr. Issam Smear. And we do have some copies of this to give away, so I want to just mention that right at the outset. Love to have you pick up a copy of Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, because it will give a full understanding of where we are today and the call of the church to be the hands and feet of Jesus in this area. Also, it would be just like to open up the phone lines, too, if you have maybe been involved in work of refugee resettlement and know that many churches and individuals are very active in that, and we're thankful for those demonstrations of Christ's love. But I'd love to hear your story and love to have you join in the conversation. So, Matthew, with that, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, this, we're not necessarily going to, you know, talk news and debate those things, but the president's order certainly caused a firestorm, and it does show that there's some pretty strong emotions surrounding who is allowed in our country. I'm thinking maybe just to begin, if you could summarize our current policy on refugee resettlement in the U.S.
Sure. So I guess I would say currently, prior to last week, the way the refugee resettlement program worked and has worked since the Refugee Act was passed in 1980 is that the president designates, under the authority of Congress, designates a number of refugees who will come into the U.S. each year. Last year, the last full year, was 85,000, which is a large number, but it's also less than 0.5% of the refugees in the world. So it's a small share of the overall, but a significant number of people. Those individuals are screened abroad and vetted. They come from a number of different countries, not all from the Middle East, as sometimes we might think from the news. In fact, over the last decade, there have been more Christians who've come in as refugees than Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or any other religious group. And then once they are screened and allowed in, they're met at the airport by one of 9 national refugee resettlement agencies. World Relief is one of those, and we work through World Relief offices and local partners like Arrive Ministries in the Twin Cities. To empower local churches to be a part of that integration process for refugee families. So that's the Ministry of World Relief has been doing since 1979. And we, of course, want to continue and will be continuing that mission to the best, to the extent that we're allowed to under new governmental policies of empowering local churches to serve the most vulnerable.
The policy now has put a 3-month or a 4-month moratorium on, although I think what the total number of refugees is what down to 50,000, right, down from 80,000. Is that right?
Yeah. So the executive order released last week does a number of things. One of them is a moratorium for 120 days on refugee resettlement. Under the order, it says there may be some limited exceptions for persecuted religious minorities. At this point, we have no information from the State Department on if they will be using that exception or if there will be anyone at all coming in or not. It also puts an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees in particular, and then there's a further bar for 90 days for individuals, not just refugees, but including refugees from 7 particular Muslim-majority countries. And then the last thing, well, there's actually a number of things the order does, but the other relevant thing the order does is cuts down to 50,000, the total number of refugees who could be considered for a settlement this year. And it's worth noting there's already been 32,000 who've come in this fiscal year. That started last October. So for the rest of the fiscal year, it'll be, compared to what it has been in past years, a trickle of arrivals if and when the program reopens in 4 months or so.
Maybe we should just take a moment to define what we mean by refugee and how does someone get that status? I mean, this is different than an immigrant, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. So refugees under U.S. law, as well as under international agreements the U.S. is party to, are individuals who have fled their country of origin because of persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution that specifically has to be related to their race, their religion, their political opinion, their national origin, or their social group. So in a sense, they are a subset of immigrants because they are people who are residing in another country. That's basically what an immigrant is. But they are unique in that the conditions in which they had to flee, which was usually not something they really chose to do, but they had no choice because of persecution but to flee their country. And there's a global record at this point, at least in recorded history, of 21 million refugees in the world today who meet that definition of a refugee. Again, most of them don't come to the United States. Most of them don't go to Europe. Most of them stay, in fact, more than 85% stay in the first country that they flee to, which is usually not necessarily a wealthy country either. So, for example, you have a huge number of refugees from different parts of Africa living in Kenya right now. Ethiopia is in the top 5 host countries for refugees because it happens to be next to Eritrea and to Somalia, both of which have been situations where there's been significant conflict. Syrian refugees have been in the news a lot. The vast majority of them are either in Turkey, where there's 2.5 million, or in Jordan, where there's somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million, and Lebanon, where there's more than 1 million at this point. So in contrast, the U.S. has received about 20,000 Syrian refugees since the conflict began.
Just those numbers are almost overwhelming when you hear it. Think, 21 million refugees. I mean, this is unlike anything that's happened in world history, isn't it, what we're experiencing today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the closest parallel would be going back to World War II with the level of mass displacement that there was, or after the Vietnam War. That's where our World Relief Refugee Resettlement Programs had their origin, was with refugees from Vietnam, from Laos, and other parts of Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War, but the numbers weren't as significant as they are now.
It is a one that is, I guess, puzzling and challenging before us. The talk often, as a result of this executive order, has been about safety, and maybe we can just address that up front because the way the policies has been established. I mean, safety really was not should not have been a concern.
Well, that would be my opinion, at least, and I think the facts bear that out, that we completely affirm the importance and the appropriate role of government and President Trump's authority to prioritize the safety of American citizens, and that's an important role that he has as president and that our federal government has, and a role that I think is ordained by God, biblically speaking. But where I think I would strongly disagree is the idea that the current refugee screening and vetting process has failed, or even as the president said at certain points that there is no screening and vetting process. That's not accurate. There's a very thorough screening and vetting process. Any one of the refugees who World Relief resettled last year could tell you how thorough it was. It usually takes at least 18 months, sometimes 2 or 3 years. And that's just for those, that's once they're referred for consideration for a settlement. Again, the vast majority of refugees never even get referred for consideration to come to the United States. Once that process begins, it involves background checks, biometric checks, in-person interviews with very carefully trained officers of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It's coordinated with the Department of State, Department of Defense, the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI. And I think the best evidence that the system is actually working quite well is in the last, well, since the Refugee Act passed in 1980, there's been about 3 million refugees who've come into the United States. There's been a grand total of 0 American deaths from a terrorist attack perpetrated by someone who came through that refugee resettlement program. Now, that doesn't mean all refugees have been perfect. There's been a very, very few isolated cases of people of concern who fortunately have not taken any American lives. But the cases are so incredibly few. The Cato Institute did an analysis, and they found that the odds of an average American citizen being killed by a refugee-turned-terrorist since and this goes back even to the 70s, were 1 in 3.64 billion per year. You're far, far more likely to die by getting struck by lightning than by being killed by a refugee who commits an act of terrorism. So I think it's appropriate to take security precautions, and our country has done that and done so very effectively. We don't think it's appropriate to shut off an entire program. And frankly, refugees are shut out right now from across the world, not just from places where extremist Islamist terrorism is a problem. It's the number one country of origin for refugees last year was the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a largely Christian country. And those individuals are shut out under the new policy as well, at least for this temporary moratorium.
I'm going to talk more in a moment with Matthew Sorens. Matthew's U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, and he's authored a couple books, co-authored the book Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, and most recently, Seeking Refuge, that he is one of the co-authors of, On the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. When that came out, we're talking about what's going on in Syria, and we'll get an update on that as well. But it has become, of course, front and center news again just in the last few days. We're opening the phone lines to take your questions, your calls, maybe your story. If you have been involved and had the privilege of being involved in maybe some refugee resettlement work, I'd love to hear how it's made a difference in your life, or maybe you've come through the process. It'd be great to have you join in as well. 877-933-2484 is our phone number, 877-93-FAITH. We also do have some copies of Matthew's book, Seeking Refuge, to give away, and we'll do a drawing for that at the top of the hour. If you're looking for some clear insight and information on this topic as opposed to just listening to sound bites, then we'd welcome you to sign up for a copy here today at 877-93-FAITH. More with Matthew Sorens coming up. Today about what's happening in the world with those being displaced and those seeking refuge. Seeking Refuge is the title of a recent book from Matthew Sorens. He was one of the co-authors of that, along with Stephen Bauman and Dr. Sam Smear. Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. And the question that one needs to address is, what will rule our hearts? Is it fear or compassion? Matthew serves as the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. And Matthew, let's talk about that, fear or compassion, because it seems like those two have been sort of pitted against each other more clearly in the last, even just the last few weeks.
Yeah, and I think especially security and compassion have been pitted against each other in a way that they really don't need to be. I mean, we have a long history in this country of a refugee resettlement program that is both remarkably secure and is living out the I think, the best of our American history in terms of a virtue and a value of compassion and welcome. Certainly it's a biblical value as well, and it's been an opportunity for local churches to be involved. But I do think fear is a powerful emotion. It's a powerful motivator, and I feel some of that as well occasionally. I mean, not necessarily. I have so many refugee friends, it's hard for me to be afraid of refugees. But I'm prone to make decisions based on fear as well, sometimes based on things that I don't fully understand. And I think that's become very common, especially with rhetoric about refugees that's not based in reality. I mean, if it was true that refugees were completely unscreened, that they were floating ashore on the beach and we didn't know who they were, which is closer to the situation in Europe, very, very different than the U.S. refugee resettlement program, there might be some more legitimate concerns. But I think even when we are afraid, it's interesting because I mentioned Europe. I was in Germany a year or so ago, and it was fascinating to me to hear from so many German Christians who didn't say there was no risk, but they saw it as such a privilege to welcome the much, much larger numbers of asylum seekers arriving there in Europe. And they were seeing so many who were from a Muslim background coming to know Jesus and saying, isn't this, you know, we've been praying for the 1040 window for years, and now they're coming to us. So praise the Lord, and, you know, let's do everything we can to show them the love of Christ. And there's certainly churches in the United States that have that attitude as well. But I think overall we could learn some things from our European brothers and sisters or from our Jordanian brothers and sisters. There's World Relief Works of churches in Jordan who are just responding heroically to enormous numbers of refugees coming into their country, even though they have relatively few resources themselves. Here we're so blessed, and here we have the benefit of a very thorough screening process, but still I think there's a lot of wariness among a lot of American Christians to reach out.
I mean, part of this, I assume, is probably a reaction to, you know, some of the abuses in the system in Europe, or maybe where they didn't have as thorough screening as they should have, and so we've kind of picked up there, we've seen what's happened there and assume that it could happen here, I guess.
Yeah, and we perpetuate some of the concerns that may be true in Europe that are not at all true here. So there's this persistent, you know, rumor that, well, all the Syrian refugees coming to the United States are military-aged men. That's not quite true in Europe either, but they do actually skew more male, and often it's people who, making a dangerous trip, left their wife and children behind with hope to arrive, get established, get asylum status, and then be able to bring your relatives over on an airplane, you know, in a safer way. That's not how it works in the United States. In fact, because the U.S. actually prioritizes the most vulnerable cases, we have a lot of single moms who, in many cases, lost their husband in the conflict in Syria. In fact, more than 70% of the Syrian refugees who have come to the United States have been either women or children under the age of 14. In fact, about half have been children under the age of 14 from Syria.
So a real need. And of course, the crisis in Syria is not abating, right? I mean, there are still people just pouring out all the time, right, from that nation.
Yeah, sadly, and it should be a point of prayer, I think, for all of us. The situation in Syria is still very stark. People are still leaving. People are not in any significant numbers, you know, going back because it's safe, although the situation is quite desperate in some of the countries that they fled to as well. Maybe not in terms of violence, but in terms of just poverty. I mean, you're usually, for example, in Turkey or Jordan, most of those literally millions of refugees are not authorized to work, and they're not living in camps for the most part either. A small percentage are in camps where they may have some sort of humanitarian aid. But most are just living in cities, and they're paying rent. And what happens to rent costs when 2 million people move into a country quite quickly is rent costs go up. That's supply and demand. But because I actually talked to one of my neighbors here in Aurora, Illinois, where I live, who's a Syrian refugee, who's now here. But when they were in Turkey, he and his wife and his sister were all working full-time, and they weren't able to cover their rent payments. I mean, that was, you know, they were being paid very little because they weren't actually authorized to be working, and in actually very dangerous conditions. But those situations are quite desperate for those who are in, you know, in that second country as well. And that's where World Relief has said, we do want to respond to the United States, but we're also going to be responding in Turkey with local church partners and in Jordan, and in as many locations as we can, to help alleviate some of the suffering and to equip the church to really be a beacon of hope in the midst of it.
So it does seem, I mean, if there was one word that would describe it, it seems like vulnerable at every level. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, the refugee has to be referred for consideration. Well, if you're under maybe some persecution because of your religious beliefs or race or whatever it might be, it seems like if word gets out that you've been referred, that maybe just puts a target on you as well and then get taken advantage of if you do get to some other place.
Yeah, unfortunately, we talk in the Seeking Refuge book about sort of the spiral of vulnerability, that once you're vulnerable for one reason, there's unfortunately a strong correlation between refugees and being victims of human trafficking, because there are traffickers who will take advantage of that vulnerability. There are, you know, there's unfortunately a lot of sexual violence as well that is related to the vulnerability that a refugee already has experienced. And that just compounds the trauma that people have experienced having had to flee in the first place. And most people don't flee their country the first time something bad happens. I mean, we've talked to people who it was, well, when our neighborhood was bombed for the third time, and we felt it was by the grace of God, our house hadn't been hit. We had to just make the decision to leave. And, you know, those are incredibly difficult decisions. I mean, we've met refugees who carry their house keys in their pocket because they were a homeowner back in their country. They had a life there. They were, you know, and it varies from one country to another what that experience was, but so many people would be desperate to go home, but it's not possible and it's not safe for them.
Say more about, you know, some of the trauma that many refugees live with, and can the church be a part of providing some healing even in that respect?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things we have really tried to do at World Relief. It's always a factor of how much, you know, of limited resources, but my co-author, Isam, who's a brilliant psychologist and probably one of very few Arabic-speaking experts in trauma therapy in the world. I mean, he is originally from Jordan and came to the United States to study at Wheaton College and then went on to do his doctorate. And so now he lives here and serves primarily Middle Eastern refugees who have gone through, in many cases, horrific suffering, whether from Syria or Iraq. A lot of the Iraqi refugees that we've served were, many of them were persecuted Christians. About 30 to 35% of the Iraqis who've come in the last decade have been persecuted Christians for whom it was their faith that made them particularly a target. Another significant percentage served the U.S. military as translators or in some other way, and that made them then targets as the war sort of wound down in Iraq for terrorist groups. Isam writes in the book about a particular young man who was tortured, left to die actually in a dumpster, found by a police officer, presumed dead, but was not dead. And by the grace of God, he lived and eventually was able to be, because of the persecution he'd experienced, he was able to be resettled in the United States. And the good news is God made human beings remarkably resilient. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is real, and it can be debilitating in some ways, but it's also treatable. And Isam writes about that in the book, and even using this one particular young man as an example. But we've seen people experience so much healing, and beyond the psychological issues, we've also seen so much spiritual healing as well. People who, again, many refugees are already believers, but many others are not. And as they come in, we don't, you know, force anyone to be a Christian by any means. We don't trick them into it or coerce them, but we do love them, and they know that we're Christians, and they know that the church teams that welcome them are Christians. And it's very common, actually, that they then eventually ask that question, you know, why is this team being so kind to me? Why is this church being so kind to me? This isn't what I maybe heard about Christians in my country of origin. And we get to do as 1 Peter 3 says, be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks us for the hope that's within us. Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of people make that choice to follow Jesus.
We're going to talk more about what that looks like and some tangible ways in which we can welcome the stranger among us. We'll even talk about caring for the stranger, what the Bible has to say about that. Matthew Sorens, U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, talking Seeking Refuge, the name of his co-author of the new book. We've got some copies to give away. You can sign up for that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH, and you can join the conversation as well with that same number.
You will be shaken,
talking today about the least of these, the most vulnerable, those strangers among us, Seeking Refuge is the title of a book from Matthew Sorens, co-authored it with Stephen Bauman and Dr. Sam Smear. It's On the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. We've got some copies to give away, and you can sign up for that or join the conversation at 877-93-FAITH. Matthew serves as U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. And we want to talk about how we can mobilize our church and as God's people, what that means for us individually. But say a word, Matthew, first maybe about just the biblical mandate. Jesus was a refugee, and we're called to care for the stranger. Give us a little biblical framework.
Yeah, you know, I think that's maybe, I grew up in a great church, you know, learned to love and see the Bible as my authority. But I think if you would have asked me a decade or so ago what the Bible said about refugees or immigrants, I wouldn't have come up with much. And I think I've at least had a blind spot there. As I've gotten into this work, I've realized how much the Bible speaks to God's particular concern for the refugee, the immigrant, the vulnerable foreigner. In fact, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for a resident foreigner is the word, or an immigrant is the word ger. That word alone appears 92 times in the Old Testament. So it's actually a very repeated theme. Often we find that word for an immigrant right alongside the word for the orphan and the widow, as groups of people whom God specifically mentions as vulnerable, whom he loves, whom he cares for, and whom he commands the Israelites to care for as well, in part because of their own history as foreigners in the land of Egypt. And God basically says, look, you should remember what it's like to be a foreigner because you were foreigners. Your ancestors were foreigners. And that's a lesson I think that Americans could probably take to heart as well. If you're not completely Native American, we all have those refugee and immigrant stories in our past as well. And then in the New Testament, we have the idea of hospitality, which doesn't just mean having your friends over for lunch. In the Greek of the New Testament, hospitality is philoxenia, which is the love of strangers. You know, my three-year-old daughter has already learned that stranger danger. You're supposed to be afraid of strangers. And I get why we tell that message to children, but I think that, you know, for adults and for families, that's not actually how we're supposed to see strangers. We're not supposed to see them as a threat. We're called to see them as to love them, to welcome them. Hebrews 13 suggests that some people, by welcoming strangers, have entertained angels without realizing it. So there's a lot there in Scripture, and much more than that, there's a great commission dynamic as people who are not yet believers come into the country. There's a persecuted church dynamic as many others who are Christians and have been persecuted their faith come in, and Matthew 25 says that when we welcome them, we are actually welcoming Jesus himself. And the reverse, which is a little scary, is also true. If we do not welcome them, Jesus says, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. So there's a lot there biblically. And that applies not just to refugees, although, I mean, the persecution dynamic is perhaps particularly germane to refugees, but it's to immigrants in general, not just those who have come because of persecution. We're called to love and to welcome.
Yeah. Now, before we talk about, you know, what that love and welcome could look like, one of our callers, Jill, had asked, you know, is there a good reference maybe online or other ways where we can understand kind of maybe the executive order, but also understand kind of our current policy on refugees? Do you have a recommendation? Just go to World Relief, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, so if you go to worldrelief.org, and especially if you – there's a button there on the front page, worldrelief.org. There's a button that says Advocate, and if you click there, there's an explanation of kind of breaking down what the executive order actually says. It's complex because it says a lot. It's a significant piece. There's a piece about standing with refugees, and if you click on that, you can see options to advocate, options to give to. Unfortunately, this is going to have a very significant financial impact on World Relief and our partner ministries, as we won't be receiving any refugees for the next 4 months. So there's a lot of good information there. Of course, seeking refuge, we don't have the information on the executive order in the book because it hadn't happened yet, but on a broader understanding of the resettlement process, the vetting process, and that biblical mandate as well.
Seeking Refuge, the name of the book, On the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, recommend it to you. It is published by Moody, and we do have some copies to give away here at the top of the hour. Say a bit about, you know, how we can show love, what that looks like for the church and for us as individuals, just some just common sense ways in which we can really demonstrate the care and concern for the vulnerable.
Sure. I mean, one of the ways that we do that at World Relief is just what we usually call a good neighbor team, or a refugee life ministry, as we call it there in Minnesota, actually. But it's an opportunity for a local church, it's a small group from a church to, again, once refugees hopefully start arriving again, to meet a refugee family at the airport, to walk alongside them for the first several months to a year that they're in the country, helping them with learning English, you know, understanding basic everyday life things like grocery shopping or public transportation or medical bills. And I should say, even if we don't have arrivals for the next 4 months, and we don't anticipate that we will at this point, and maybe not even, we don't know when it will reopen either, which is concerning to us. But there are families that arrived last week, and not every one of them actually has a church-based volunteer. So there's still opportunities to connect. And I would actually say, given the way this has become such a political issue, and the rhetoric has been so heated, your refugee neighbors and other immigrant neighbors as well need to hear even more than ever that they're welcome, that there are followers of Jesus who are glad that they're here. So I just really encourage people. There's a lot of fear right now, and I know that a lot of fear drives some of these policies among some American citizens, but there's also a lot of fear among a lot of refugees and immigrants. And we've had many people call and ask, you know, who fled the conflict in Syria, you know, are they going to send me back? Well, there's nothing in the executive order that would lead them to be sent back, and that's not within the authority of the president, actually. They are lawfully present once they've been admitted under laws written by Congress, and Congress would have to change those laws, which is unlikely. But there's still a lot of those fears that people could be sent back to a war zone or that someone could harm them even in the United States. And there's been a few, unfortunately, a few cases of that, or at least of harassment and that sort of thing. So I would encourage people to reach out, whether it's to World Relief or depending where people are listening, there's other resettlement agencies as well. Most of them are faith-based in one way or another. And also then to advocate. Now is an important time for people to speak up, to let your elected officials know. If your church wants to continue to be able to welcome refugees, let your elected officials know that it's an important ministry, and the church, you know, doesn't want the we want security, of course. I think we all want that, but we also want the opportunity to minister to people and for that opportunity not to go away as it has, at least for the time being.
What's your vision for a good picture of refugee resettlement? I mean, you know, again, we had what, 80,000 last year. Not much in comparison to the you know, the 21 million displaced around the globe. But what would, if you could paint the vision for us today, Matthew? What would it include?
Yeah, I mean, no one that I know thinks that the solution is for the United States to take all the refugees in the world, and that's not, you know, a realistic plan. But I do think at a time when the number of refugees globally is so much higher than it was even 5 years ago, I personally believe it was appropriate for President Obama to try to raise the number of refugees admitted from 70,000 then up to 85,000. And we had been working until a few days ago under the assumption that it would be 110,000 this year. And that's, you know, when you spread that across 50 states and, you know, literally thousands of churches in those states, it's not a significant, you know, that's doable for our country. We have a history of doing much more than that, in fact. If you look back at 1980, there was 200,000 refugees, more than that, who came in just in 1980 alone, most of them from Vietnam. And frankly, that was at a time when our screening and our resettlement processes were a lot less refined, and there was, you know, people then were afraid not that they were going to be terrorists, but they were going to be communists. You know, that was the fear of the Vietnamese. And actually, the majority of Americans didn't think we should be resettling Vietnamese refugees, but I would argue that they're now an amazing success story. The Vietnamese American community, almost entirely refugees and their family members, have higher incomes than the average U.S. citizen. They're less likely to live in poverty. And then on a spiritual, you know, if you look at this spiritually, the Vietnamese living in the United States are far more likely to be Christians, many times more likely to be Christians than Vietnamese living in Vietnam. And part of that is so many of them were welcomed by local churches, both Protestants and Catholic as well. That welcomed them in, that, you know, as they loved them, had the opportunity to point people to Jesus. And my hope is that that would repeat itself. I think it is in small ways. I think this new policy will limit that very significantly. But my hope is that, you know, 30 years from now, it might be the Syrian American community who we would look at and say, you know, most of them were Muslims when they came in, but they were loved so well by churches, and almost of them are, or many of them are Christians. And they're thriving in this country and contributing and giving back, as we see with almost every refugee group. If you give them a few years, they integrate really well.
Oh, may it be so. Well, Lord, just bless Matthew and the work of World Relief in this strategic area. Matthew, I want to give you a chance to introduce a friend, a co-worker, and want to hear a bit of her story. So bring Liz on the line. But Matthew, just say a little, Liz, and tell us a little bit about her.
Sure. Well, I'm so glad to have Liz with us. Liz is a good friend of mine and also a coworker at World Relief, and with the Evangelical Immigration Table, which is a larger coalition of Christian groups that we're a part of. So Liz's job is basically to work with churches in throughout the Midwest. That's kind of her region of focus, to help encourage distinctly biblical thinking about refugee and immigration issues. And she also is an immigrant herself. I'll probably let her tell that story if she's comfortable. But I think even beyond the refugee issue, there's a lot of other policy changes that are on, or at least are possible right now as it relates to immigration. And Liz, I think, is probably able to speak to that even better than I am in terms of some of what we're anticipating and what the effects could be.
Liz, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Would you take a few minutes to share a little bit about your journey, if you would, and how you've come to be part of the Evangelical Immigration Table?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So I was born in China, and my mom actually had come to the United States first on a student visa. So she was doing graduate studies in Iowa. And later was able to land a job in the Chicagoland area. That's when she switched from her student visa to a work visa, an employer-sponsored work visa. And that was also one I could come in as a dependent and when she could financially support having me here. So I came to the States at the age of 10. Didn't know English, but was excited to start life here and then join my mom here. And I should say, rewinding back a little bit, that when my mom arrived in Iowa, by God's grace, we come from an unbelieving atheist family background, but God just brought into her life two Christians. One was her former English teacher, and the other was a school librarian. They just loved our mom and took her into their family. She would spend holiday breaks, vacations with them. And even when my mom moved from Iowa to Chicago after she got a job here, they made sure to connect her to their extended family members here, also believers, who would later introduce her to a local church, a Christian Missionary Alliance church here in Wheaton, Illinois. So I actually started coming. As soon as I came to the States, I started kind of tagging along with mom to church. God just began working in my heart, as well as my mom's, throughout all of this time of bringing us to faith. But little did we know that soon after I came that our immigrant journey would take a very drastic turn. As I mentioned, mom's work visa was employer-sponsored in 2001. My mom changed her jobs, and because it's an employer-sponsored visa, she needed to apply for a new work visa. Our immigration lawyer, unfortunately, completely forgot to attach my paperwork, as I was a dependent, to my mom's work visa when she changed jobs. And as a result, I just fell through the crack and became undocumented. I lost my status. And because he had forgotten it, he also forgot to tell us this, and we came to find out sometime later about the situation. And my mom had approached our state senators, had approached other immigration attorneys, and the response that we got at the time that there was no way of reinstating my status short of self-deportation, incurring a 10-year ban, and not be guaranteed to come back to the States again. So my mom actually didn't tell me this until I was closer to high school age, not that I would have really understood this. As a 12-year-old, the fine points of U.S. immigration law. And so high school was a difficult time for me, just on top of wrestling with, you know, my identity as a developing adolescent, but also dealing with the fact that I technically did not belong to a place that I came to call home. And I, without status, I could not drive, I could not work, and I could not go to college at the time, even having worked hard and did well in high school. But I think it was really during this time of wrestling, of darkness, that God used his people to show his love and affirm my identity in Christ. My youth pastor, Christian Missionary Alliance ordained minister, became actively involved in learning about immigration and advocating on their behalf, both within the church, but also in the public sphere. So he would attend meetings with our state legislators advocating for sensible reform on immigration, a way in which, you know, people like me, people without status, who have not have had any criminal background, who have worked hard, paid taxes, to find a way to reinstate our status. There were also church family that prayed for me, that gave me rides because I couldn't drive. And I think it was really God answering the prayer of his people that I was able to enroll in community college after high school, which was indiscriminate against legal status. And then after 2 years, able to transfer to Northwestern University on a scholarship and be able to complete my bachelor's degree. Even coming from a single parent household, I could not be qualified for any federal or state financial aid because I didn't have legal status. And even having graduated from college, I still could not work until 2012 when the Obama administration implemented Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA in short, which granted folks like me who came as minors, who go through background checks, meet certain qualifications to obtain temporary legal status. And that's what I have. Started working in the private sector for a little bit after getting my legal status worker authorization, and then moved to a community to do ministry and met Matt, who recruited me to do this work. And that's when I realized, and I was really convicted by God, that while I didn't have status, while I didn't have a voice, there are people like Matt Sorens, there are people at War Relief and other partner organizations that were speaking up on behalf of people like me. And that now that I have temporary legal status, and there's still millions of immigrants without still living in the shadows, that it was my turn to advocate on their behalf. So that's a little bit of my journey, kind of faith journey that God has led me on to do this work today.
We'll take a quick break and come back and talk more about some ways that we can speak up. What would that look like from Liz's perspective? And Matthew, I want to say thank you for joining us. I know you've got a full day ahead of you. Blessings to you as you continue this important work. It's so good to have you on with us today in Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a quick break and come back and talk more with Liz Dwelling in just a moment. Talking these moments here with Liz Dong, who's staffed at World Relief, serving as the Midwest mobilizer for the Bibles, Badges, and Business Coalition, working with faith, business, law enforcement leaders, and other stakeholders on immigration advocacy and policy. And she's also worked closely with the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's a national coalition of evangelical leaders advocating for sensible immigration reform. She told us a bit about her story. Liz, are there maybe a priority list of things in terms of speaking up and sort of wise reform? That is there kind of a 1-2-3 list that you have that say if we could get the maybe it's employer sponsored work or if it's something else? What's on the top of your list?
Yes, one of the things that we're seeing that's of kind of immediate attention of concern is some statements that President Trump has made while he's campaigning that he was going to undo Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. So that's the executive order that was put into place to provide temporary legal status for children who were brought into the U.S., immigrant children. And we don't have any clear next steps in terms of what he will do. But there have been efforts, bipartisan efforts in Congress, in both the House and the Senate, of pushing for a bill called the Bridge Act. So the Bridge Act would actually provide protection for immigrants who came here as children to allow them to continue to work, continue to be able to have legal status to remain here. And so right now that is the bill on the table. Should President Trump undo DACA, that would be a piece of legislation that would help protect Dreamers.
Okay. Yeah, a important. And I mean, it's whatever we do is going to have to be some sort of bridge, won't it? Because the system is parts that work and system in ways that it doesn't work. And there's no kind of one size fits all, I think, is there?
That's right. And what we're advocating, we understand that Congress really should be the body to pass laws, right, including immigration laws. And so we're really advocating for Congress, for legislators to work across the aisle to forge a solution, a sensible solution that would uphold human dignity, that would keep families together. We're seeing many families that are being torn apart through deportation. Many have not convicted a crime, an offense, criminal offense, and ultimately providing a earned pathway for those who qualify towards permanent legal status. And at the Evangelical Immigration Table, we very much see this as a biblical issue. And Matt has, you know, talked about this as well. The fact that immigrants coming here, they either, you know, are bringing vibrant faith with them or are likely to become Christians themselves. I am a case of that. I'm a product of the church welcoming the stranger here. And I became a Christian actually while I was an undocumented immigrant here.
It seems like work is a pretty key part of this, isn't it? I mean, just the employment issues. I mean, there's work that needs to be done, and there's people that are looking for and wanting to work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see that the work participation rates among immigrants are much higher relative to the native born. And that's because, especially for undocumented immigrants, they're not eligible for welfare. They're not eligible for food stamps. So if they don't work, they also don't eat. And we find that the vast majority of undocumented immigrants, 75%, that's an estimate put out by the Social Security Administration, actually pay taxes through property taxes, through sales tax, through work tax. So on an annual basis, they receive $15 billion from individuals whose Social Security do not match their identity. So we see that. We definitely see a strong work ethic and a willingness to work and to provide for their families. And that's, I think, you know, in terms of economic reasons, that's one of the primary reasons for why people come to looking for a better future for themselves and their children.
Just curious, is your mother back in China, or was she able to find other work and still stay in on a work visa?
So my mom and I are the only ones here in the States now, and she's working, and then the rest of our family members are in China.
Mm. And is there a hope that they could someday come over? Are they interested in that or not?
Yeah, you know, it's been – so while I was on – before I was able to attain DACA, I was not able to travel abroad. So I wasn't able to visit my family members or have them come here to the States. But under DACA, there was an allowance for individuals to apply for an advanced parole to visit ailing family members, and my grandparents are elderly in age. But I was able to actually share the gospel with them for the first time in person in 2014. But that's definitely something that we are communicating with our family members in China, and continues to be my heart too as I pray for revival, for God to move. But I think through me coming to know Christ, my family now has an opportunity, an avenue to also hear the gospel.
Liz, thank you for sharing your story today and for the work you're doing, and for advocating, speaking up on this important issue. Is Evangelical Immigration Table maybe a resource to look for if people want to find out a bit more and how they might join in the work?
Absolutely. You can find us online. The website is evangelicalimmigrationtable.com. And there are various resources for how to talk about immigration, how to address immigration from a biblical perspective.
evangelicalimmigrationtable.com. Check that out. And again, as we talked with Matthew Sorens a bit earlier, you can go to worldrelief.org, find out more about what's happening in the world of refugees, and click on the advocate button there. We'll give you some current information. Also, look for a copy of the book Seeking Refuge as well from Matthew Sorens and others. That will be a good resource. Liz, thank you for joining with us today, for being on Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Liz Dong, who is now working with World Relief, serving as the Midwest Mobilizer for the Bible's Badges and Business Coalition. And you can find out more about the good work of World Relief on their website, worldrelief.org. And if you want to hear part of this interview again, we post the conversations on our show page. Go to Connecting Faith at myfaithradio.com.